The book of Joshua, chapter 9, verses 3 and 4. But when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, they worked craftily and went and pretended to be ambassadors. And they took old sacks on their donkeys, old wineskins torn and mended, old and patched sandals on their feet, and old garments on themselves, and all the bread of their provision was dry and mouldy. It's interesting to note the two different responses of all the different kings of the Canaanites, their different responses to the warring successes of the children of Israel. What was it that moved all the kings together to attack Israel? Except the Gibeonites. They decide instead to try and come to make terms of peace with them. What was it that made them react in two different ways? Well, if verses 9 and 10 are true, if what the Gibeonites said to Joshua and the Israelites was genuine, it was because of the name of the Lord your God. For we heard of his fame, and all that he did in Egypt, and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites. What the Gibeonites seemed to fear, if what they said in verse 9 and 10 was true, we don't know if it was true. They may have just, it may have been all part of their deceit. But if it was, what they feared or what they saw was, it's the God of Israel. That's where their power lies. In the God they have. It's their God that does it for them. Whereas, you see, when you read verse 1, with regard to the other kings of Canaan, when they heard of it, they decided to attack. What is the it? What is it they heard? Now, I don't think it's watertight, but it would seem to me that it follows naturally from the previous two verses, or at least the last two verses of the previous chapter. What do you find the Israelites doing after their second success in capturing the city of Ai? You find them there in verses, in chapter 8, verses 34 and 35. You find them there worshipping God. They read all the words of the law, and there was not a word of all that Moses had commanded which Joshua did not read before all the children of Israel. Isn't it amazing? There's something about the people of this world that upsets them and disturbs them when they find you worshipping God. Here are all the kings of the Canaanites. And what is it that disturbs them? It just simply seems to be that the Israelites are worshipping their God. And you know, there's nothing like worshipping the one living and true God, which disturbs the forces of evil. I was speaking to somebody recently who's just been converted a couple of weeks. And he says, my friends, he says, they're disturbed. They're disturbed. What have I done to them? I've done nothing to them. In fact, he says, I haven't even said anything to them. I've just started reading my Bible. I've just started praying. I've just started going to church. But it disturbs them for some reason. What have I done? And here it is here. When the children of Israel worship their God, pray to their God, thank their God for giving them their deliverance, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Amorites, they all gather together and have a discussion. We will attack the people of God. Maybe if you do not find Satan disturbing your life, maybe it's because Satan does not see you genuinely worshipping God. Because there's something about the devil that he just detests seeing people worshipping God genuinely. And he wants to disrupt it. The worship of God also, you notice, seems to make the enemies of God afraid. For some reason it makes them afraid. This young fellow I was speaking to, he said, they seem to be terrified. And I've done nothing, he says, and I've said nothing even. They're terrified of me. What's making them afraid? I think we want to learn from all this also. The worship of God is what life on earth is all about. It's actually why we were made. It's why we were created. And it's why we were put on planet Earth. Do you ever ask yourself the question, why am I here? Do you know what the answer is? You are here to worship God. That's why God put us on earth. That we might worship God while we are on earth. Have no fear. God is being worshipped in heaven. Have no fear about heaven. Our concern is God worshipped on earth? In fact, if we go right back to this story about the Israelites, why did God say he was going to deliver them out of the land of Egypt? What was Moses to say to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, why he was to let the people go? He said, let my people go that they may worship me. That's what life is all about. And if you are finding yourself dissatisfied with life, maybe it's because you're not fulfilling the purpose of your creation, which is to worship God. What a long, long time we take to learn. The way to happiness is to worship God. Now, here is God, and he has begun to accomplish what he has promised he would do, deliver the Israelites from the land of Egypt, and take them into the promised land of Canaan. He has promised them they will be able to drive out the fierce men, the fierce kings, the fierce warriors that are there, and they have begun to do that. Now, of course, whenever they have begun to do that, naturally, the Canaanite kings rebel. Half of them, no, most of them, decide, as we've noted, to use force. But the Gibeonites decide to use subtle infiltration. Do you see why the Bible depicts Satan as a lion and as a serpent? He goes about as a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. If that doesn't work, then be the subtle serpent. Infiltration. Cover things up. Do things behind people's backs when they aren't looking. That's the way the Bible portrays Satan. as a roaring lion or as a subtle, slippery serpent, snake. Well, let's look first of all at the plot of the Gibeonites here, and then secondly at the error which the Israelites made. First of all, the plot of the Gibeonites. Like the men of Jericho, they too heard about the Israelites. They too believed the report of about the Israelites conquering the kings on the other side of the Jordan, how God made a passage in the Red Sea, how their God parted the River Jordan. They heard it, they believed it, and they became afraid. Isn't it interesting, by the way, how sometimes unbelievers believe more than the Christians? Remember when Christ rose from the dead. Remember the disciples couldn't remember about it. That he had promised, that he had said he would rise from the dead on the third day. But the enemies remembered. They said, remember how this deceiver said he'd rise again the third day. Let's seal the stone around the sepulchre. They remembered, and the believers had forgotten. Now and again, they put us to shame. They expose us. Now, they were afraid. But of course, being afraid of God is not a mark of grace. The devils believe and tremble, afraid of God. I read recently, people today are still afraid to die. But they don't believe in God. But they're still afraid of death. They don't believe in hell, but they're still afraid to die. They don't believe in a day of judgment, but they're still afraid to die. Now, whatever it was I read, I can't remember the book, but apparently the reason is that people are still afraid of death, although they don't believe in these three things anymore. They're still afraid of death because they're afraid of the unknown. That's what they say. That's what this survey apparently came up with. Well, here are the men of Jericho, and they are most definitely, and we might say naturally, afraid to die. And so they desire and they seek peace. That, of course, is to their credit. And when you think of it, the other kings sought war. Now, it's possible to desire something and yet not to seek it. You want something, but you don't seek it. Maybe because you're just bone lazy. Maybe it's because you just think you have no hope of obtaining it. But at least the Gibeonites, they sought what they desired. However, would it not have been so much better if they had sought God? If what they said was true in verses 9 and 10, it's because your God is so powerful. Well, if that was why don't they change their gods? Why don't they convert and worship to the God of Israel, if that was the real reason? However, you see, seeking peace itself can be self-love. And of course, that's exactly all that they have. There's no grace working in them. Just self-love. We don't want to die. And so they opt. They opt for the way of deceit. They're going to avoid death by fair means or foul,
And in this case, it is foul means. Now, it is always sad and always bad to build on deceit. I wonder if I can remember that. I've forgotten it. There's a little poem that warns children, don't build. What a web we weave when first we begin to deceive. What a bad thing it is to build or plan on deceit. But that's what this people did. Let's come, pretend we're neighbors, and make terms of peace with them. Now, maybe you say, well, maybe they heard what Deuteronomy chapter 20, verses 10 and 8 says. You remember, we noted this before, when Israel came to the outskirts of the city, before they were to destroy them, they were to offer them terms of peace. Deuteronomy 20 verse 10. When you go near a city to fight against it, then proclaim an offer of peace to it. And it shall be that if they accept your offer of peace and open to you, then all the people who are found in it shall be placed under tribute to you and serve you. Now if the city will not make peace with you, but would make war against you, then you shall besiege it. You say, well, maybe they heard about that. Well, if they did, why didn't they just come and confess, look, we're from a far country, we know we can't overpower you, we want to make terms of peace. Why bother deceiving them who they are? Why pretend to live near them when they don't, or when they do? What's the point? What's the point in deceiving them? There's an availability, there's provision made. If you want to have terms of peace, you can have it, just tell them you have it. Now you see, there's lessons there for you and me as Christians. First of all, we get in the habit of sin, don't we? We get in the habit of deceiving people. We get into trouble, and the natural thing that comes to us is to tell a lie. Tell a lie. Oh, we've got to get out of doing the natural thing that comes first to us. We've got to get out of the habit. We've to learn to do the spiritual thing. Oh, what a constant web we weave when first we practice to deceive. That was the thing I was trying to remember. Well, you see, we get in the habit. Here they are. They're in the habit of deceiving their enemies. Just carry on. It's the first thing that comes into their mind. There's no need to deceive. Just ask for terms of peace. But then, there's another lesson. Satan hides the very truth of the gospel from us. They had this condition that they could openly have used. And they don't use it. They don't realize it. They don't grasp it. And how many of us here today don't use the gospel? You ask people why you're not a Christian. And they say, oh, I'm not good enough. As if Christians were good enough. I'm not good enough. Listen, it's because you're not good enough there is a gospel offered to you. You're not good enough. Well, tell that to God. Say that to God. Pray that to God. Tell him you're rotten through and through. Tell him you're not into religion. Tell him you can't understand his Bible. Tell him you've committed sin upon sin upon sin. And ask him to forgive you. That's the gospel. You don't need to be good. You just need to acknowledge you're bad. That's the gospel. Acknowledge and confess your sin to God and ask for forgiveness. No need to deceive anyone. There's no need to pretend anything to God. There is no way forward with God if you pretend you're something you're not. Don't go to God and say, oh, I'll do my best from now on. Go to God and say, I have a corrupt nature. Go to God and say, I'm rotten through and through. I need a new heart. I need Christ in me. Go to God and say, I am nothing, I have nothing, I can do nothing. Forgive me for nothing. That's all you need to do. That's the gospel. And you know it, but you don't realize it, and you don't use it. Well, let's turn now to the error which the Israelites made. Although at one level we can say that the Israelites were genuinely deceived by the Gibeonites, we can say that at one level, but on another level, they were not entirely blameless. First, they went by appearances only. Old clothes, mouldy bread, cracked wineskins. They put the emphasis on what you can see with your eye. That's a bad mistake. They went by what you can see with the eye. But you know, the world is bigger, far bigger than the things you can see with your eyes. And you see, they should have laid much more emphasis on the answer which the Gibeonites gave to their very, very good questions. But that they did not answer straightly. They did not answer specifically. When they are asked, where do you come from? They didn't say, oh, we're Gibeonites. We come from here, just east of and north of. No, no. Oh, well, we're from a very, very far country. Let's just change the subject. We're from a very far country. Now, that should have sparked red lights flashing. And they laid far more emphasis on the mouldy bread, the old clothes, the cracked wineskins. Instead of, hey, they were pretty edgy with these questions, weren't they? So they went by appearances only. And then secondly, they made a very, very hasty decision. What on earth, tell me, was the hurry? Why did they have to come to a decision that day? Why not investigate properly and verify their credentials? And if verse 17, well, according to verse 17, they were only 3 days' journey away. In fact, actually, it's been calculated, they're only 20 miles away. If they'd just waited, if they'd just journeyed for 2 or 3 more days, they'd come across the homeland. What was the hurry? Why didn't they verify the credentials? Now, there's a lesson there we have to learn about Satan's tactics. That's the way he tries to catch you and me and every Christian. His tactic is to create a crisis and to rush you into a quick decision. That's the way he operates. Make a hasty decision. Text everyone, phone everyone. Quick, quick, I want an answer. Quick, I've got to get this by. That's got the overtures of Satan's disruption, which he creates. It's one of his tactics. You've often come across the question, how can we tell that a temptation is from the devil in hell? How can I tell if it's Satan that's tempting me to do this? Or is it my own sinful nature which is drawing me out? How can I tell which is? And the standard answer to that question is, well, if the temptation comes upon you suddenly and you're initially shocked at it, then that's a temptation from Satan in hell. A sudden temptation shocking whenever you think of it, instantly think of it. But on the other hand, if you're chewing over something, if you're meditating upon something, if you're planning something in your own mind, that comes from your own sinful nature. Satan rushes you into a quick decision. Our sinful nature likes to premeditate. It likes to play about with temptation. Tempting. Play about with it. Serious. That's your sinful nature. But thirdly, and most importantly, the big, big error of the Israelites was very clearly mentioned in verse 14. They did not pray about it. Verse 14. Then the men of Israel took some of their provisions, but they did not ask counsel of the Lord. That's the secret. That's the key. They did not pray about it. Now you see, according to Numbers 27 verse 21, there was provision made in Israel whenever you got yourself into a situation and there was doubt, there was a question about, you didn't know what to do. You had to choose this or that and you didn't know what to do. There was a provision made. You went to the high priest. You remember the high priest had a little pouch round his neck. A little bag. And in that bag there were two stones. And these stones were called the Urim and the Thummim. Now it would seem, there's not a lot of detail given in the Bible, but it would seem that these stones were used by the high priest to get an answer from God. You find the Bible saying, and God answered the high priest. And this is what he did. He would frame the problem before God so that God would have to reply negatively or positively. And he'd take the two stones in his pouch and he'd put his hand in and he'd take one of the stones. One of the stones was a positive answer and the other stone was a negative answer. And so the high priest found out the will of God through the Urim or the Thummim. And Israel could have used that if they were sufficiently exercised or spiritually exercised. You see, they acted hastily and did the natural thing. But Christians and the people of God are not meant to do the natural thing. We're meant to do the spiritual thing. And the spiritual thing was to go along to the high priest, place this issue before the high priest, and let him get an answer from God, whether they were genuine or whether they were frauds. But they did not, the indictment is they did not inquire at the counsel of God. This was a huge, huge decision for Israel. It had horrendous consequences. And what Israel should have done, they should have waited a while to verify the credentials. That would have been nothing very spiritual about it, just sensible to verify their credentials. Secondly, they should have prayed to God, gone to the high priest, asked counsel of God to direct them. But they didn't do it, and therefore we are reading about them, 3,000 years afterwards, and you and I have to learn from their mistakes. And so as God would help me, I just want to say three things in conclusion, three kind of lessons we can learn from it all. First of all, at the end of the day, God overruled this. At the end of the day, Satan's ploys were found out. Be sure your sin will find you out. At the end of the day, Satan's ploys are found out. And at the end of the day, Satan's tactics are overruled for the advancement of God's kingdom. As I said earlier, Israel were a large part of this, they were deceived. They should have known better, they should have done better. They didn't, but they were deceived. God overrules for good even the sly tactics of Satan. And at the end of the day, you see, these Gibeonites, they became very, very useful to the Christians. Very, very useful. They became woodcutters and carriers of water. And if you read the rest of the history of the children of Israel, you'll find out just what a boon, what a help they were to them. God turns the ploys of Satan. He overturns them, he overrules them to advance the kingdom of Christ. But you see, early on we see, oh, what a success Satan had over us. Just wait. God overrules the apparent successes of Satan. Maybe you're struggling today after a success that Satan's had of you. Just wait and watch God overrule his so-called success for the advancement of Christ's cause and kingdom. Lesson number 2. You and I don't simply need the power of God. You and I need the wisdom of God. And you and I need the wisdom of God every day. Not just in certain crisis periods. If you and I had the wisdom of God every day, we would discover that we don't need the power of God every few days. You know what it's like? You do your own thing. You do your best. And then you find yourself in trouble. And you have to cry to God, oh, deliver me out of this situation. Perform a miracle, God. Take me out of this. We need your power to deliver us. If we followed every day God's wisdom, we would not every occasional day need so much to cry for the power of God. If we just act on the wisdom of God daily, we won't find ourselves in so many predicaments every few days. As well as the power of God, we need the wisdom of God. And finally, and really quite importantly, note how the Gibeonites finally achieved their safety. They were found out to be deceivers. They were caught red-handed, as it were. But they were still saved. They were still delivered from death. Now, why? Why? They were caught out. They were guilty. But they were still delivered. Why? Because of the oath. The oath which the rulers of the congregation made and promised to them. Because of the oath, you can read it there. Because of the oath, in fact, the congregation murmured against the rulers because they made the oath. It's mentioned at least once that because they had made the oath, they couldn't go back on the word. But isn't that the gospel? We're guilty. We're found out. But we can be forgiven because of the oath which God has made to sinners. Anyone, anywhere, anytime, who repents and believes will be forgiven, even though they're caught red-handed. Even though you're caught red-handed, even though you're guilty, you can be forgiven because of the oath of the gospel. Whoever will call on the name of the Lord will be saved. Whoever believes on the Son has everlasting life. Keep God at his promise. He's promised eternal life to anyone who believes and repents. Keep him at his promise and repent and believe. May God, the Holy Spirit, make his word effectual to every one of us. And let's just bow our